and welcome to State of the Revolution, the Michigan Progressive Podcast. I'm Benjamin Klon. My co-hosts today are Mara Zumberg.
Oh, hi.
And Liana Sharon.
Hi, how's it going?
On today's program, we're talking about Tulsi Gabbard, a congresswoman from Hawaii who rose to national prominence and caught the attention of many progressives in 2016 when she resigned as vice chair of the Democratic National Committee in order to endorse Senator Bernie Sanders' then candidacy for president. She recently announced her own intention to run for the 2020 Democratic nomination, which has some wondering whether she is a viable or better alternative to the likes of Elizabeth Warren or even Bernie Sanders, who has yet to definitively declare whether he's running again. In addition to her support for Bernie 2016, she has been praised by progressive Democrats for joining the protests against the Dakota Access Pipeline, calling for the reinstatement of the Glass-Steagall Act, and supporting universal health care. However, many on the left have been deeply critical of her and question her progressive credentials, especially with regard to her positions on foreign policy, her support of Islamophobic leaders, and her history of opposing LGBTQ rights. Now, there are bigger names who have announced their running since Gabbard has, people who probably have a much better chance of winning the Democratic nomination, and we'll get to those folks in another episode, but I thought that, as a progressive podcast, it'd be worth examining her candidacy and its implications for the left. So to talk about Gabbard and her upcoming campaign for the Democratic nomination, we are joined by the vice chair of the Michigan Democratic Party's Progressive Caucus and friend of the show, Dr. Ayman Kafagi.
Hi, nice having you.
Yeah, thanks for being here. So, Ayman, I know you've spoken out against her a few times since she gained national recognition, but I want you to explain exactly why you think Tulsi Gabbard should not be the Democratic nominee in 2020.
Well, so I think it's going to be a huge blow to that progressive movement if she becomes the nominee. Having someone who's disingenuous running on a progressive platform is even worse than having someone who's not progressive at all winning, because then now you abort the momentum. Trump already did that with hijacking populism, right? So we had a populist movement with Occupy Wall Street, and it continued with Bernie Sanders' campaign. But before Bernie entered, there is Trump going down the escalator and harnessing all the anger on the street and talking against the 1%, but at the same time talking against immigrants, against Latinos, against Muslims, and just hijacking that populist moment from, I think it should have been Bernie Sanders' moment. He lived all his life to lead that moment. Now, if Tulsi Gabbard becomes the nominee and she becomes the standard bearer of what a progressive is, that's going to be a disaster.
Well, I mean, basically, I agree. I think that there are a lot of ways in which she does not appear to be progressive on a number of levels. I think that the tendency of the powers that work the strings, so to speak, the 1%, is exactly what Ayman just described, is that they like somebody who will, yeah, you'll talk against the 1%, but actually enact policies against minorities and other marginalized groups, and never actually get around to doing the stuff that that you talked about regarding the 1%. You know, so you have Trump, who, you know, has Muslim bans and has anti-LGBTQ stuff, like the just was announced, was it today or yesterday, about the Supreme Court allowing the ban on trans people in the military to go through, for example, and all this kind of stuff. But when it comes to all of his rhetoric about the 1%, that won him a number of people that have said that they would have gone for Sanders if Sanders had won, had won the primary. When it comes to that, what do we get? We get gigantic tax breaks for the wealthy. Okay. And you know, this is actually the same play that the Republicans have been running against poor people for a long time, is gin up anger against, for example, you know, religious minorities or racial minorities, or you know, you talk about, you know people who use marijuana, for example, or people who believe that freedom of speech includes the right to, you know, speak against the country, including by burning the flag, for example. And they'll talk about all of that all the time, and they'll get lots of votes. And at the same time, the people that they're getting votes for are not actually getting the policies that they're asking for, but the wealthy are getting the policies that they want. So this is we need to be careful about thinking that just because somebody has some progressive credentials means that that they're actually going to be in favor of enacting progressive economic policies, for example. So I could, for example, see somebody who, like Gebhardt, is, you know, talks economic populism and this Islamophobia, xenophobia, that kind of thing, and you could get the same kind of thing with a Democrat who, you know, doesn't do all the stuff that we talk about for the to help people who actually, to help people who aren't in the 1%. But you get all of this racist and discriminatory policies towards marginalized groups, for example. I'm not sure if I was terribly articulate there, but
I think marginalized groups on a global scale is more my concern with Tulsi Gabbard as our president. It seems as though on the American scale, she prioritizes American citizens over the rest of the world, which is something a lot of people are looking for in a president. However, that's a really dangerous thing, especially when she puts it under the guise of anti-interventionalism, because she might have those views of not involving ourselves in pointless wars, but the way she goes about it would be to support dictatorships and fascist governments, and I think that's a serious problem that we on the left need to be like thoughtful of when we're picking who we want to nominate.
Because what you're saying is we don't want the same policies that we've had for the last 200 years, for example.
Right, and we don't want them guised in new language that make them seem shiny and appealing.
I think on the surface, it might appear to some people as if she is anti-war, but in reality, there's nothing about what she's saying that is actually opposed to war itself. It's just
she just opposes spending American lives.
Exactly.
But if that means supporting a dictator that's going to put lives in other countries at risk, that's not something that I feel we should support.
Okay, so the American foreign policy was always based on the best interest of Americans in general. And let's be more precise, best interest of American businesses,
right.
American capital,
right.
The 1%. And the times of economic prosperity was based on the American army being able to secure safe markets for American products. So those are all the wars we went for since the inception of this nation. That has been the case. We never fought because we wanted to spread democracy. When the Soviet Union came after the Bolshevik Revolution and after the and during the period of the Cold War in specific, there was this conflict between that model and the Soviet model. Our model was carrot and the stick. We would go around the world, have our wars, establish our supremacy, open markets, but also say that we are the beacon of liberalism. We are the beacon of freedom, and we have the Statue of Liberty. We welcome all people to come along. Of course, at that time, the journey was very difficult. Right, for people to cross the Atlantic was not easy, so you wouldn't get millions of people coming across, so you can easily give that lip service, right, and then welcome the few who are coming. At the time, I'm sure that the 1% were welcoming immigrants because economic growth is also proportional to the growth of your population, so you needed people to come and work. But the Soviet Union, and acting like they were communists, I don't think they were ever communists except for the first few years after the Bolshevik Revolution. But they were selling a different model, and they were questioning out loud with a lot of resources our model, and that prompted us to have the civil rights laws and desegregate, because it was causing us a lot of trouble. You cannot decouple what happened in Vietnam from what was happening at home. People were saying, you still have whites only water fountains and restaurants, and you're having black people sit in the back of the bus. Oh, well, we would rather go for a system of complete equality, right? On the other hand, you're just being hypocrites. So there was a concerted effort of cleaning up that image and actually showing that we are going around the world invading countries for the right reason, for actual liberty and for actual democratic values. The problem is, every time an establishment claims that they have, like, that they are standing for something, some people believe that. That means some soldiers believe that. Soldiers who become officers, and officers who become leaders in the army. Some even CIA officers would come to believe that. You would have politicians get elected and continue to believe that. So as they believe that, they actually start to push in that direction, that we're intervening for actually saving lives, for humanitarian needs. So this number of people can increase at some point and decrease at some point, right? What and we have been in this, we have been having this conflict where we go intervene, and then you have other politicians and people from within the establishment pulling back and saying, no, what we did was wrong. We cannot do that much. We have the example of Abu Ghraib in Iraq, where people from within the establishment were really angry that our soldier tortured the prisoners of war over there, right? Like, there was actual rage from within. I'm not saying that this represents the establishment, but I'm saying that this conflict does exist from within. We have also people who believe sincerely that if we walked in there, then we are responsible for it. We cannot just create a power vacuum and leave. And that's sincerely what they believe. They were keen for the best interest of people. We cannot just go and recruit people who cooperate with us and believe in the liberal values and just walk away from Afghanistan and leave them to Taliban to kill them all, right? We have to at least act responsibly in that respect. Then comes someone like Tulsi Gabbard, right? Her just saying, no, screw all of that. It's just all about us. And we're going to pull back, right? It's all about our best interest. That, and it's right, not...
It's comments like those that actually got her praise from David Duke, the KKK.
She's consistently on Fox News. Mm-hmm. Like, I've seen a lot of video clips of her speaking with them, and they for a Democrat, they speak of her very favorably.
Well, actually, they are consistent with what they want, with their ideology. They really do not care for labels.
That's true.
Right? They see through how our politics works, and they like that. It is an increasing number of people who are like, we don't want to intervene around the world because that's not serving our best interest. Or if we intervene, we intervene up to the point that serves our interest, and then we don't care anymore, right? So when you say, I want to withdraw from Iraq all of a sudden, and I don't care what happens after that, that's problematic. Mm-hmm. And you say, oh, okay, I'm going to go back only to bomb the few people who, or the few groups that are hurting me, and then I don't care what happens after that, right, then that's a problem, right? So I'm not saying that we need to intervene in new places, but at least in the places that we were in, you cannot just have an indifference about what happens to the people over there, right, and say, I'm very hawkish, that's her word, I'm hawkish when it comes to terrorism.
But she's a dove on foreign, or on domestic policy. That's, I think that's her word as well, like not, that's or, also her.
Sure.
Yeah.
But I mean, then it is, I am against intervening in Iraq, I'm against removing Saddam, I hate him so much. I think he was an example of, like, dictatorship and fascism. He killed people outside of his own country, and he killed people inside his own country. He's responsible for millions of lives. But at the same time, the power vacuum was horrible, was horrifying for the area, and it was not our business to intervene on behalf of the people of Iraq. But we intervened. We removed an authority from there. There was a power vacuum, and we cannot just say, we are not responsible for what happens after that. You can say, I'm not going to go in anywhere else. That's fine. My point with Tulsi here is we have to understand her politics. I'm not questioning her integrity. I'm trying to understand what she wants to do for real, right? And I see in all her politics since she was 20 up until now that there is a sort of consistency. She is very conservative when it comes to homosexuality, when it comes to the LGBTQ community, when it comes to Muslims, when it comes to anything that is foreign to what we call the American norms. And she is very conservative when it comes to our foreign policy, meaning America first is basically her motto, right? When she evolves, they say, quote-unquote, evolves on LGBTQ rights, she says, and I'm using her own words, she went to the Middle East, she saw what happens there, so she believed that our model of liberalism is the right model, and then she decided that she's going to become liberal on that aspect because she saw what it leads to. So what she brought from the Middle East is that we need to be more libertarians. She didn't become more tolerant to the LGBTQ community. She doesn't believe that they are equal. And according to her, again in other interviews, she articulated that she believes in that the government should not intervene or should not prevent marriage from gay marriage from taking place. But she has not changed her view of the LGBTQ community at a personal level. I could respect that from other people to say that, but here I'm noticing that she has sort of consistency. She has not evolved in terms of accepting the other, because that would have shown in terms of how she would deal with the Muslim community. They showed her in clips, she visited Syria on the back of the Syrian government, and she met with some Muslims in camps there who are allies with the Assad regime, and she showed that she was very friendly and she talked to them in a friendly way. We have to remember, Assad himself claims to be a Muslim and claims to be actually defending Islam and the right version of Islam. And so a lot of his followers are Muslims. So if she's buddying up with him, she has to show that picture overseas. Donald Trump goes to Saudi Arabia and shows like he likes them. I love these guys, right? So that does. I'm not sure.
Like a picture that, with him and his hand on the.
Right, I was just thinking about that.
Yeah.
So
very, 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 very like Star Chamber kind of imagery.
when that picture first came out, one of my favorite things that I saw was someone said, "Can you imagine instead of Donald Trump that being Barack Obama, just watching Alex Jones stroke out on camera?"
Yeah. So contrast that with what Obama said to the Muslim world when he went there. He was talking about respecting the difference in culture regardless of the politics of it, right? So, and that's what we will never see from her. Okay, so there are the Muslim Americans who became citizens, who contributed to the society, who became more or less westernized, right? And she's very tolerant of those. The ones who are allies with her allies, she's fine with those. But everybody else, no, she's not accepting of them. And then her insistence of using radical Islam to describe the groups, that there are groups over there, and refusing to accept that there are so many other socioeconomic factors that lead to these groups emerging is very troubling to me, because if she were consistent about her view of the relationship between religion and violence, then I would see that in her talking about Israel, for example.
Right. Right?
Mm-hmm. There are religious rights groups, mm-hmm. religious right groups that are very fascist, that that actually push the government and force the government to kill civilians. Right? And I don't see any connection, not that I want to make a connection, I'm not seeing her making any connection between the actually, she is very friendly with that government. Right. I see that's the same thing with the government in India. She's not making any connection between her own religion, Hinduism, and the crimes committed by her own sect, by people, members of that own sect against Muslims. That doesn't bother her at all. Right. And I don't see anyone calling the Buddhists who claim to be killing the Muslims in the name of Buddhism in Myanmar, nobody's calling them like radical Buddhists,
right?
Mm-hmm. And I don't want them to call them radical Buddhists, but for consistency purposes, right?
If you're going to do that, then you should be doing it everywhere.
Exactly.
Right.
You should be talking about radical Christians in this country, for example.
Right.
Or, you know, radical Israelis or radical Jews,
right.
You know, in various different places.
Yeah, that's the issue. When you see it that way, you try to find, I'm not saying she's inconsistent, I'm saying that the only consistent factor here is that is being hawkish, mm-hmm. and being for the America First. Right, because it is that section of the world that if they believe in a nationalist, they unite in a nationalist way around Islam, then you are talking about 1.5 billion people,
mm-hmm.
right, having that nationalist unity, then this is a second force,
mm-hmm.
and they want to unite Americans, right, behind a nationalist idea of America First, right?
Right.
Fight that threat that's coming from that side. So, and they want to abort it, because if it's a potential of another rising power, then they would want to fight that.
Like with Libya, in essence. Like they don't, I guess when you're talking earlier about Americans coming in and taking out power structures and creating a vacuum, that would be, it wasn't just America in Libya, but that I think would be a key example of that. And Tulsi herself has alluded to Libya, and I think a very inaccurate way in talking about our interventionist policies.
Libya is actually an example of how unsophisticated the anti-war movement here in the United States is like. And that's a whole other reason why they can drool over Tulsi Gabbard, right? And they,
right.
It is just mind-boggling. But Libya is a very complex situation. I disagree with Kucinich when he said, there wasn't a threat of genocide over there. Well, there was. There was a genuine uprising in Libya.
Yeah.
It was, they got the bug from Tunisia on one side and Egypt on the other side,
mm-hmm.
right? And it was a genuine uprising. It was very strong. It was actually stronger than both countries, right? In a sense that they got organized faster, got organized better. And they were actually going to bring down the regime without the help of any military coup.
Right.
Like what happened in both and the countries to the east and to the west. But Gaddafi was going the length. He was going to actually bomb his own people like Assad did. And we saw that with Assad. So intervening to prevent a dictator from bombing his own people when people have shown that they already have risen.
That's,
nobody is acting on their behalf.
Mm-hmm.
They have risen. That is a good thing. But they tried to just, we bombed him, we prevented him from attacking his own people, and it's all you. Actually, Obama tried to do that. Right? But on the other hand, they allowed their own allies in the region to act by proxy, or they just turned a blind eye on their allies acting in the region. So you have the Gulf region not happy with regime change, not happy with the rise of actual democratic forces or the rise of a government that's actually governed by the people.
Mm-hmm.
To a certain extent, they were very afraid of that model spreading, so they started to intervene there. They started to fund certain groups there. And the U.S. was watching.
Right.
And didn't intervene, didn't tell them as much mm-hmm. as, stop it. We're not going to sell you arms anymore.
Okay.
So
right.
arms
and
will
I'm sorry, I think this is an important conversation, but I want to try and just bring this back in a little bit. One thing that I wanted to ask you about was, you know, a couple of years ago, in some remarks you had made about Tulsi Gabbard, you said that there are many progressives that are overly emotional and don't properly vet politicians when they come to the forefront marketing themselves as progressives. And you cited the failure of progressives to give enough scrutiny to Barack Obama, to Elizabeth Warren, and on certain issues, even Bernie Sanders. So I was just wondering if you could expand on that, maybe kind of explain what you mean.
Okay, so when Tulsi Gabbard announced, a lot of conversations happened on social media about her candidacy, and people like me, I'm not the only one, were bringing up her record and saying hell no about her. And a lot of people were unaware of anything she has done in her life, but the fact that she stepped down from the DNC and stood in solidarity with Bernie Sanders. And for that, they loved her.
Mm-hmm.
And everything they saw about her was through the glasses of that one action.
Mm-hmm.
So I believe that's overly emotional. And immediately after she did that, the socialist worker in the UK published an article and said, a progressive Islamophobe? Question mark. Right? And they immediately questioned her. Right, they already had her record, and we didn't have any progressive outlet who spoke about that. Well, indeed, we were busy with the Bernie Sanders campaign.
Right.
I understand that, but people continue.
I think a lot of people in the moment, a lot of progressives in the moment, were just kind of desperate to take everything they could get.
True, and we were very desperate to find any allies because mm-hmm. Bernie Sanders at that point got like what, two super delegates?
Yeah.
By that point in time, the entire establishment was against him.
Especially someone who's coming from an establishment seat of power.
Exactly, so. From the DNC.
Right.
I
was curious, does anybody know why she stepped down? Because I thought, I think about it, it seems to me a more powerful move is to stay on and endorse him.
I don't know this for certain, but I think it's because the DNC rules wouldn't allow her to openly endorse him while keeping her seat.
Yeah, well, again, so I would say a more powerful move would have been to just do it, and if they wanted to remove her, then they should have made that argument. So that to me that makes it seem like more of an opportunistic move.
I don't know if that's a DNC rule. I think she was objecting.
Yeah, exactly. I don't know for sure, but yeah.
I think she was objected. She said, "I found that the DNC is basically siding with Hillary Clinton, so I'm stepping out because that's wrong."
Okay.
Right.
Okay, that makes sense.
That's different.
So there was no vetting at all. But I think that hunger for people who can actually lead the movement, stars for the movement, I feel that progressives feel orphaned, right? That nobody, they don't have any figures of any influence whatsoever. And I think that's true, but also by the nature of progressivism, right, you should not have a central figure at all. But people are also, while they're believing in these values, we are a product of our own culture, right? And the culture values star power so much.
Mm-hmm. Unfortunately.
Yeah, so Obama is the most strange, is the strangest thing ever. Obama did not lie. A lot of people say he deceived us. He lied.
No.
His platform is his platform in 2008 is exactly what he did afterwards. He didn't do anything that was any different from what he promised to do. And he even promised, even though the Affordable Care Act is slightly to the right of what he promised on the campaign trail, he said when asked how is he going to get bipartisan approval of that, he said that he's going to compromise.
Mm-hmm.
And he's going to try to meet them in the middle. He stood and said, there is no white...
Isn't that kind of the Democratic mantra for the last 30 years? We're going to meet them in the middle, no matter how fucking crazy they are.
Well, no matter how far they move goalposts to the right, we'll meet them in the middle, wherever that middle now is,
and
allowing them
window,
to define where the middle is.
And the whole window of politics shifts to the right,
right,
as time goes.
Right.
Cowards. The most famous line from his speech in 2004 that made a lot of young people crazy about him was, there is no red America, there is no blue America, it's the United States of America.
It was a colorblind America.
Yeah.
That was like a very bastion of that time period, I feel like, is being colorblind. And if you are individualistically not racist or loving of everybody, then you're all good. Because that's the problem, is you just don't like people. It's not societal structures that we have been put in place that keep people oppressed. It's racism, individual racism.
Yeah,
I mean,
so why did progressives like him, right? Not just because of his oratory powers. He had a progressive background.
Mm-hmm.
He was a community organizer.
Mm-hmm. He picked a good place to start in Chicago as well.
Exactly.
Coming from Hawaii. Yeah.
So with that start in his career, right, they felt like he probably is going to move in the direction they want, although he never promised that. So it is like someone falling in love with someone, the idea of someone, and not paying attention that guy or a girl never promised them any of that stuff, and then feeling disappointed that their expectations were not met. It's like, and the writing was on the wall in the first place, right? So this, I cannot explain that by any way except that people are emotional. That's one thing. The other expectation is that people really want the change to happen from within the establishment. They're really desperate to going to the toll booth, voting one time, get the right guy, and that's going to solve the problems. And that's why you find progressives not voting in the midterm elections and not running for local offices and whatnot, because that's how things should go. We go and vote one time, then we go smoke weed all day long right? And then everything is going to be okay.
Prop one pass with flying colors.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, I think that's part of the way that, you know, here in, you know, American culture and society, we're conditioned to believe in top-down structures. And I think Liana can speak a lot to that.
Yeah, I mean, that's, you know, we're trained starting much earlier, but certainly all the way through school. I mean, the way that school is structured itself, you have an authority figure that you're supposed to sit down and be quiet and do what you're told. And then when they ask you questions, you're supposed to make sure to answer the way that you were told to answer. You know, you look at the kind of, you know, the way that some people are starstruck, not just by Hollywood actors, but by politicians or by, you know, well-known or business leaders or, you know, the Kardashians, who are basically famous for being famous because they have a bunch of money. I mean, when you have a culture that has this really skewed sense of values. We talk about good values a lot of the time, but the way that we actually behave in our society is very much, you know, whoever's got the authority, whoever's got the power, there's an awful lot of people that are gonna follow that because that's what they're used to doing, often without even realizing it, and they'll justify it. I mean, people will give all kinds of justifications for it, but an awful lot of the time, the justifications amount to all of the things that I just said, rather than anything about what's the policy, what's the plan, what's the idea, what are the ideas behind this person or this group of people. So I think the but I think there's another aspect to it as well. It's not just that people are used to following authority figures. It's also that we haven't had a discussion in this country in any serious way in public about what the other options are. You know, so for example, Bernie Sanders got a ton of people behind him. I mean, I've said this before. He came out and said, you know, I'm a democratic socialist. I believe healthcare is a human right, free college, all this stuff that, and a lot of people stood up and said, yes, that's what we're all about. And then they looked around and saw that there were a whole bunch of people. It wasn't just them, because for a long time, and I can tell you, growing up, becoming politically aware in the 80s, you couldn't talk about that kind of stuff in public without getting attacked, and much more viciously than you get attacked now. You still get pretty viciously attacked. But now we know, after the 2016 campaign, there's an awful lot of us out there, and so it's easier to go out and talk about this stuff. But we've not had that conversation, so people don't have a good idea what are the other options. And it's really interesting, actually, reading the conservative reaction to, like, the Green New Deal or the kind of stuff that Bernie's proposing and so on, and they're making arguments that are so disconnected from the reality of what's being said, because their idea of socialism comes from 50 years ago, or actually more than that. And it isn't actually socialism. It's Stalinism. They think that socialism and Stalinism are the same thing, which means that they haven't studied history. But that's another story. My point is that it's...
They're historical revisionists.
Well, I think a lot of them just haven't studied it. There are some of them that have, you know, so my point is that it's a combination of the, of the culture of follow the leader, and a dearth, a lack of clear understanding of what some of the alternatives are and how those things might go, that makes it very easy for people who aren't particularly well informed on some of these things, or who have very, very conservative ideas, to present themselves as if they are progressive, and get a lot of people to follow that, to follow them on that, even when, you know, once you examine some of their positions and see how those positions fit together, like what Ayman's talking about with Tulsi. Mm-hmm. you know, they just, it just falls apart. They're not, you know, they're nationalists. And there are plenty of nationalists that are perfectly fine with providing a certain level of social welfare to their favored group of nationals. Okay. That includes white supremacists. It includes people who have a broader definition of who are the nationals that they want to provide services to through the government. That brand of nationalism is not something that that American politics has a lot of nuance for. And I'm talking about in the broad population, so people don't necessarily recognize how this, how these pieces fall together into something that looks a lot more like Trumpism than it does like progressivism.
I'd like to comment on the nationalism part and how a brown woman like Tulsi would buy into nationalism, because we always associate, we say, why nationalism, and Trump is racist and Steve Bannon are racist, right? And here is the thing. The issue is not just race. It's race and culture and identity, right? So we have always, white people have always welcomed people who have decided to acculturate, of course, to a certain extent, and of course not with the same exact privileges, but to a great deal, they accepted that because they believe people can come, acculturate, and can empower the whole. When you say, I'm going to close the borders today, and I'm going to protect the American identity and culture and American way of life, you find a lot of brown folks and a lot of black folks who believe in that and would agree with you and want things to stay the same. From the perspective of white nationalists, that's great. That stops the browning of America, right? Because it was, if the trends continue, then they would become a minority or less than an absolute majority. And they don't want that to happen. So if you stop it, then as a white nationalist, I like that, at least as a temporary goal, to continue to be the majority. But from a perspective of other people who made it into this country, even though they were minorities, right, it preserves their superiority, right, and it empowers the country and the way of life they come to believe in, they embraced, right? So the two groups can meet, the two groups can actually cooperate with each other under the banner of American nationalism. It's not white nationalism that they are together fighting for. It is American nationalism, and this is not unique to America.
No.
We have seen it in so many other countries. I have heard it from people in the Middle East who describe themselves as, my religion is Christianity, but I am a Muslim nationalist, right? So that, because that is the majority of the people who are over there, and that's the best interest of my country, if I put my country first, is to belong to the total, right, or to the bigger group, and then they describe themselves that way. Now, of course, this is not a very popular point of view at this time in the Middle East, so not anymore, but at one point, that was a thing. So Tulsi is an American nationalist, right, and is finding a lot of common ground with white nationalists, and some of those white nationalists are willing to not say we are white nationalists, are willing to make it like, okay, we can make it an umbrella of American nationalism.
As long as she plays into the myth of the model minority.
The model minority. The other point I wanted to talk about is that the emotional progressive that I mentioned before, that includes people as much like as Cornel West. Mm-hmm. You will be surprised how Cornel West received Obama. Not just he supported him so much, mm-hmm. but he had a forum with Susan Neiman in 2008. After the primary, before the general elections, they were talking about the role of race and religion in the presidential election. But they were having a very open conversation, and Cornel West started talking about his reservations about Barack Obama and his concerns about America, how America is going to receive him, and whether he's going to win, and whether religion and race is going to stand against him. The funny thing is, he was not happy. He expressed, "I'm not happy with the fact that he is not presenting himself as black, as really authentically black." And he said, "I'm waiting. Maybe he's doing that to win the elections, not to surprise, not to shock white people, mm-hmm. but maybe afterwards he's going to act differently." He mentioned that he is trying to make white people so comfortable that in his speech accepting the nomination, he did not say Martin Luther King, which Martin Luther King is it's a household name, mm-hmm. right? But when he quoted him, he said, "A preacher from the South said," so and so. Everybody knew who he was referring to, but he didn't mention the name Martin Luther King. That's how far he went, mm-hmm. to tickle mm-hmm. black folks, mm-hmm. right, who would be happy with him quoting right. Dr. King, but at the same time, not making any white folks mm-hmm. uncomfortable mm-hmm. at all. So that is, so Cornel West said, I'm a little bit skeptic, but I don't think so. I think that's maybe okay mm-hmm. for the time being. How far, I mean, and that's how I'm talking about how emotional, mm-hmm. how far did Cornel West go in criticizing Obama afterwards? Mm-hmm. Right, probably more than any one of us.
Yeah.
He was really angry.
Yeah,
right,
and rightly so.
Well, yes, but I think part of the anger was also emotional, mm. right? Okay. So he was emotional sure. before. He tried to talk himself out of his skepticism mm-hmm. because he wanted to support the first black mm. president, mm-hmm. right? But then afterwards found that, well, he shouldn't have talked himself out of his skepticism. The writing was on the wall, and then became really, really angry mm-hmm. afterwards. I see that. As being wrong. That's not how you should deal with politics in the first place.
Right. Well, people shouldn't have any blind faith in any politician. Right. That's like, but I think a lot of people in America get this idea of like, this is your identity politics. Like, this is your identity. So your politics are based on that. So I know what they are already. And that's simply not the case. Like,
I want to go back to what you were saying a little bit ago about how white supremacists and white nationalists are willing to look at a broader picture of American nationalism together with people like Tulsi Gabbard and other marginalized people.
John James.
What's that?
John James.
John James. Sure. Who ran here for Senate. Right.
Yeah.
As long as, like we said, like I think it was Mara said before, that as long as they're willing to play the role of the appropriate behavior for the minority,
it's the
model minority, yeah, right? I couldn't think of the word right. Okay, I just want to point out that structure is exactly the structure that started racism in America, because originally there wasn't this concept of whiteness. People thought of themselves as Germans or as Irish or as or as Italian. They didn't think of themselves as white. I'm talking about in the 1600s, that period. What happened was that they started finding out that they had a lot more in common, the folks that were not of the 1% of the era, that were not wealthy and did not have political power. They found out that they had a lot more in common with the blacks that were enslaved here than they had with the whites that were controlling everything.
Indentured servitude and times, right?
Right, and a lot of them were indentured servants, right? And the bargain that they got offered was, you know, you're white, you're with us, you're not like them. You have, you know, there's a dividing line, and as long as you're with us, you know, you'll have something. At least you're not like them. That was the argument. So that same structure is what we're talking about now, where we have these purportedly progressive people who are really nationalist, or even if they're not nationalist, they're willing to have that kind of segregation, at least in terms of how we talk about things, how we, you know, where we differentiate between the way that different people think about the world and how we're going to treat certain kinds of people. And that's going down, that's making the same mistake that was made back in the 1600s that has led to so much of what is still terrible in our culture today. And I think it's really important to point out that direct. I mean, that's the same structure. It's exactly the same structure.
Well, it's the same structure and ideology, but the way in which the structure plays out in society is the only thing that changes. And
sure.
That continuously, if you follow that history, you can see how it has been netted out in the economy.
Sure. So can a nationalist be friendly to the LGBTQ community? That is the big question, because now there are groups among the LGBTQ community who is arguing that she evolved, and a lot of politicians have evolved. But can you actually be nationalist and not be homophobic? And has that ever happened in history before? Because the premise, yes, you wanted to say something.
Well, I was just, can you be nationalistic and not homophobic? Some people can be in society, but I think you're going to get that split still, like, if you have that. Because if you look at Israel, they have very friendly laws for LGBTQ people, but there is still that very large right-wing base that does not approve.
Are these laws a function of the liberals in the society?
Yes.
And that's a conservative concession to keep them aboard? Or are these laws embraced by the conservatives who are in control of the government right now? Right. So this is also another, I'm not claiming to have an answer, but it has never happened in history that nationalists had complete control and they were not homophobic.
That's right.
On the other hand, let me point out that Gabbard isn't claiming to not be homophobic. She's claiming that her personal views haven't changed, so she's still personally homophobic, which is to say that she's still homophobic. She just doesn't think that the government should be doing this. So the question is, one of the reasons that it's very difficult to have a nationalist who isn't also homophobic is that, first of all, they tend to be homophobic because nationalism tends to be very authoritarian, and in the history of the human species, in many ways, in many cultures, some cultures not so much, but has been. There are certain norms, and authoritarians want to follow the norms, especially the norms that they're familiar with. And so when you have somebody like Tulsi in government, and you have a large force in the culture that is trying to be more and more homophobic, the question is, you know, at what point, how hard is she going to fight? to not have that be in be a government position when all of her other positions are not only personally but also in the wider sense. I would presume from what she's said, you know, this kind of nationalism, and it's just her personal reservation about having government do that. How she, you know, if we have a more and more nationalist government, how much of that is she going to compromise in order to get other things that she wants that maybe she values more?
Did you guys see that apology video that she put out last week?
It was very flat.
I didn't see it.
So basically, she posted this video online where she apologized for her past statements against LGBTQ people, mm-hmm. for how she's hurt them and their loved ones, mm-hmm. and that she has now seen the error of her ways and urging people to look at her voting record as mm-hmm. proof. Mm-hmm. And she made this very, I think, contrived effort to appear very stoic and presidential. She tried to come across as heartfelt, I think, as mm-hmm. best she possibly could. Mm-hmm. So I'm wondering, is that something that we can... Can we discard that out of hand? Can we say that she's full of shit as a nationalist politician?
Yeah, I think that the piece that worries me is that she's a nationalist, meaning that if she's a nationalist, everything is a second priority afterwards. So she's pro-choice, but how far is she going to go defending choice, defending women's rights, if she's going to lose a big chunk of what makes nationalism work, which is white Christians, right? Mm-hmm. Or the right wing, right? That is, if she's going to lose that part of the constituency, then it's not going to work. She's not going to be able to say America first, right? So, by nature, America, like any nationalist, has to appeal to the majority. And if you are in a country where we have multicultures, right, then you can play along the common denominator for a while. But after a while, conflicts arise, and you're going to have to choose, right? And the choice here is going to be, like, let's choose patriotism, let's choose, like, country comes first, everybody is going to have to make a compromise, and it's usually the minorities mm-hmm. will have to make a compromise mm-hmm. so that all of us stay united, mm-hmm. right? That is how nationalism works. And the minorities who do not accept to that compromise, then, in the most extreme examples, as in Germany, they were eradicated, or the attempt was to eradicate them. And in Germany, it reached the point where, okay, we are very strong, we are very united, right? It doesn't matter if you compromise or not, we just don't want you anyway,
right?
So, I mean, even if they were ready to compromise was not enough at that point, at which point she will be disposed with, right?
Mm-hmm.
At that point. Now, why is Tulsi running? That's the question. I don't think she has a chance. I think that it's very far-fetched, especially if Bernie Sanders run.
Yeah.
I think that she's running to fulfill a conservative agenda. Mm-hmm. If she runs, she drains votes from Bernie Sanders.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, that's actually one thing I was going to ask you about, is because, you know, we spend a lot of time, you know, calling out liberal Democrats and centrists for basically trying to protect their favorite politicians from their own records,
mm-hmm.
right? So with this issue of the, you know, quote-unquote emotional progressive, looking at a potential Bernie Sanders 2020 run, let's be honest, it looks like he's probably going to run again. Do you think that Gabbard could take any meaningful number of voters from him? Like, do you see a significant amount of people who had supported Sanders in 2016 switching to Gabbard in 2020?
Yes, I see a lot of people who are going to switch. So, first, the millions of people who supported Sanders were not all Democratic Socialists.
Right.
Far from it. Only a small group of people were. But a lot of people supported him because they didn't like Hillary Clinton. Some of them didn't trust her. Some of them felt that there has to be a change. There was Bill Clinton, Obama, who played the same along the same line of politics, and then Hillary Clinton, who came from his administration. So now we need a new direction. So we want someone else. Someone were looking for integrity, right? And so on and so forth, right? Some people were just all about anti-war, right? And so Hillary Clinton was that one. Then Bernie Sanders was very different. Then if Tulsi runs, she is going to bring to the table, she's going to be coming with that assumption that she's anti-war, right? If we don't examine her record really well. Some people are going to say, well, Bernie Sanders is great, but she's young and she's a woman and this is the year of the woman, so she's more electable, right? So you're going to find a lot of people who are going to go her way. Of course, it's like, it's not a three-way race or a four-way race. It seems like it's going to be 20, 30 people running, right?
But let me just say something about, though, is that she is tied into a network that, while it doesn't have a huge percentage of the primary voters, does have, number one, it has a lot of people that can draw into that, because there are a lot of she has a lot of support from Indian Americans, and that community does have quite a lot of money, especially the part of the community that she's tied into, and a lot of them are not particularly engaged in politics, and she has the opportunity to bring a lot of those people in to primaries that they have not been participating in large numbers. There have been some numbers, but it's not there's certainly a lot of room for growth there, is what I'm saying. So she could well turn in some numbers, both because of drawing out that community into the process, and also because of the amount of money that she's likely going to be able to raise in that community. Very much, I mean, like we've seen with some other candidates, we've been able to tap communities that they're particularly connected to.
I think the money thing, yeah, she's going to have money. I don't think she's going to be able to have Bernie Sanders money,
no.
Right? But she's going to have a lot of money, that's for sure. But there is, I'm not worried about in terms of voting numbers.
Right.
She's going to be able to get, like, that the Indian American population is going to be able to deliver votes for her.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that conservatives can deliver votes mm-hmm. for her.
Yeah.
The Republican
true.
Party is not going to have a primary right. for their presidential elections.
That's right. True, yeah.
Right? So,
so they all have the ability to vote in a lot of different...
In Michigan, they can. Yeah. In other states where it's a closed primary and they have to change their affiliation, they have plenty mm-hmm. of time to change their affiliation.
Mm-hmm.
My instincts are right, then some people like Steve Bannon,
mm-hmm.
right, who are very much nationalists, mm-hmm. who is not married to Trump in any way, shape, or form,
mm-hmm.
right, he would be happy with a Tulsi versus Trump elections, because now
he wins no matter what. Yeah.
Right? So he can drive a lot of conservatives,
mm-hmm.
right, to go and register as Democrats in states that require that, or vote in the Democratic mm-hmm. primary. Right, rather than just go check one box for Trump in a symbolic primary in the Republican side. So, yeah, she can draw from that crowd.
I'm curious what people think about whether the conservative, because I could see, you know, if Bernie Sanders runs, I could see conservatives making the same argument that we've heard from some Clinton supporters, early on, where they wanted Trump to run because they thought he would be easy to beat. There's a lot of conservatives that think that Bernie's going to be easy to beat because they think that his progressive ideas like he's pushing are too far outside mainstream American politics. So I'm curious to see how that plays out. I'm not sure where a large number of conservatives will come down, but I think that's
conservatives are not that stupid. So when I say they will support,
yeah.
If conservatives were smart, they should have come down and voted for Hillary if they wanted to. And if Democrats were smart and they wanted, they guaranteed that Hillary was going to be the nominee, mm-hmm. and they wanted to affect things on the other side, they should have gone and supported Jeb Bush, for mm-hmm. example,
yeah.
because is basically they win either way. If Jeb Bush is the president, right. it's just a similar presidency to Hillary right. Clinton, mm-hmm. so they win either way. They were so married to the idea of Hillary Clinton herself yeah. winning, so it's not yeah. about ideology, it was the cult of personality,
yeah.
and that's why it was a problem.
Mm-hmm.
But if Steve Bannon-like and his yeah. group and whatnot, they don't care, you know, who is
would,
it?
They would gleefully love to mess with the Democratic nominations. Like, they would do that with so much, like, so many of those, like, conservative smirks would be had right after they check that Tulsi Gabbard box.
Mm-hmm.
Like,
well, not because they think she would lose.
No, but because they want to... No, but either way, they feel this is a better option for me, and I'm screwing over these people, that, like the Democrats, the actual Democrats. I'm messing up their primary. Like,
sure. I mean, I think people will respond to that. But Steve Bannon would say, I won. The idea that wins on both sides of the aisle mm-hmm. is populist nationalism.
Yeah.
And it won on both sides.
That's,
right?
Yeah.
And that's what I have been telling you.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you know, I had one other question that I wanted to ask you before we wrap up. I've seen some like progressives and people on the center left making the argument that even though Gabbard's not the ideal candidate for progressives, it's still beneficial for progressivism and leftism in the United States to have more folks like her, like Elizabeth Warren, on the national stage arguing for some progressive ideas. Do you think there's any truth to that?
No, I think it ruins. The movement splits the movement. We have to promote the idea of solidarity. So, and that's a problem that they have with some of the leaders of the LGBT community who are willing to embrace her back. Right? Where is your solidarity with Muslims? Right? Where is your solidarity with the other values that we were talking about earlier? Right? And that's a problem that they have with a lot of one issue. Oriented organizations, right? When an organization would be willing to sell the unions for the sake of environment or the other way around,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
Or you would willing to support a candidate because they have a good record on promoting single payer, but they don't care about money in politics, mm-hmm. right? Or all of that. We're never going to win that way, right? It has to be a broad solidarity of issues and minority groups, all of that. That's the only way we are going to win. So if she makes the idea of Medicare for all popular, Trump can embrace that idea.
Mm-hmm.
Like, he can eventually say to make his approval ratings good, right, I'm going to accept Medicare for all, right? But he can make it in a way that it covers everybody who is white, who is a citizen, right, and excludes everybody who is not, and makes it very difficult for people who live in urban areas.
Mm-hmm.
We have seen a lot of laws who give that who are preferential in that way. So I don't see why not. He actually said he was going to replace Obamacare with something that's bigger
and better, right?
And that he's not going to leave folks behind and whatnot. And that's not the message of the rest of the party. We have to remember Hitler's party was the Nationalist Socialist Party, right? So the idea of the government helping a lot of people while the government being very nationalist and racist is not a new idea. It's there.
In fact, it's common in those in those kinds of movements.
Yeah. It's a lot. I mean, my grandfather was a nationalist socialist in Egypt. Right. So that is, I have talked with him before he passed away, and I have seen how that plays out, right? Mm-hmm. It's very dangerous. I admired his socialist ideas, but at the same time, when it came to other minority groups, when it came to preserving tradition, when it came to Egypt first, he was pretty much there. He was willing to throw everybody else under the bus. So it's socialism for whom? For basically Arab Sunni Muslims who constitute the 90% of the population in Egypt, right? And everybody else can go to hell.
So just to point out, by the way, in this country, what we have is socialism for the 1%. And capitalist competition to the extent that that's actually a thing here for everybody else, and nationalism wants to keep it that way. They just basically want to make the same deal that I mentioned before about what was going on with whiteness and slavery in the 1600s. We'll give this group some stuff because we can exclude that group. And if we exclude that group and keep this group, then we can have the majority. And the point that I want to make there is that nationalism relies on that kind of majority, and it also demonstrates why majoritarianism is not democratic. It's not, because majoritarianism isn't well, the people have spoken. Majoritarianism is the particular group of people that happen to be a majority have spoken, and sometimes what they use their voice to do is to stomp on somebody else that isn't the majority or the largest plurality. And so democracy has to be more than just majority rule. It has to be majority rule with consent of minorities, and with power in minority camps, so that the majority cannot just stomp them out like that.
Yeah. So the neoliberal ideology that was popularized by Reagan, mm-hmm. then everybody else embraced it. Mm-hmm. All presidents embraced it until today. Created that alienation of the poor white folks. Mm-hmm. It alienated them. First, it tricked them into thinking that this is going to help them, and there is trickle down. Mm-hmm. And when nothing came down, right, then they were alienated and they were very angry. Mm-hmm. So the nationalist idea cannot come in and say, we'll just give you the white bribe. Mm-hmm. That bribe is not enough. Mm-hmm. Right, mm-hmm. There has to be some financial incentive. Mm-hmm. So talking about taking care of the poor, it's a departure from neoliberalism, mm-hmm. completely.
From Reaganism.
From Reaganism. Yeah. It is saying that we are going to give you some benefits. I'm not going to be surprised if they find that this is the only thing that's going to save them, mm-hmm. is to go as far as doing stuff like Medicare for all, mm-hmm. right? They can go that far because they have, there is enough money to go around, mm-hmm. right? They will not spend it if they don't have to, mm-hmm. right? But they can, mm-hmm. do some programs like that to alleviate some of the anger, mm-hmm. at the side and gain those votes, mm-hmm. right? But it's never going to be the difference between that and a real progressive agenda, mm-hmm. is the whole idea of solidarity. No, we are not leaving anyone behind.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And I think that's probably one of the most important things for everyone on the left to understand, is that if we want to see a true, meaningful realization of justice for everyone, that means a broad, intersectional class struggle of everyone against the ruling class of America.
And ruling class of the world.
The world, yeah. Mm-hmm. That's true, because, you know, the exploitation of capitalism is a global issue, and it's something we have to organize against globally.
Well, and it has been the issue of ignoring the rest of the world. It has been very much ignored by the left and ignored by unions, in particular, as an integral part of the left. So people keep referring to FDR, and I cannot refer ever to FDR without mentioning that he was a fucking racist.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, his And then Truman was also a racist, mm-hmm. and he was a war criminal, mm-hmm. right? I cannot, and people have to understand that the prosperity that came after World War II was not because of FDR's programs and the socialist inclination of these programs. Mm. It was because the economy was booming and they decided to give a lot of people a lot of money at that time, and this money came from exploiting people overseas.
Right. Well, right. The rest of the world was in tatters, basically, in America. Just, well, our infrastructure, our industries, they're all fine because we weren't in any part of the world that was getting bombed. So we just swept up all of everybody's resources.
Not just that, because America came on top because we threw those two bombs.
Oh, yeah.
Right, and we scared the rest of the world. So everybody was standing in line trying to please us, buy our products, mm-hmm. right, and give mm-hmm. us favorable deals. Mm-hmm. That's how the big three were selling cars mm-hmm. all over the place, right. And that's how we had prosperity. So that house and car and backyard and all of that element, all mm-hmm. those elements of the American dream that people were so happy about, mm-hmm. and they thought is like, we want to go back to this era, mm-hmm. right? All of that was a function of you selling cars, right, to exploited populations, mm-hmm. right, overseas, right? And that if we stop doing that, you are not going to get your house and the car mm-hmm. and all of that stuff. So mm-hmm. that needs to be acknowledged, right? It was not distribution of wealth. It was that there was so much wealth, mm-hmm. right, coming from a lot of poor people. Mm-hmm. That wealth was redistributed, mm-hmm. taking the wealth from
right.
third world countries, coming back here,
right.
and then basically everybody got a tip.
Right.
I mean, what you think, because people think it's like, okay, that's, it's a huge tip. Yes, it's a huge tip because the money was so good. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, if you have gotten a house and a car, mm-hmm. right, and you put your kids into through college, mm-hmm. yeah. that was your tip. And that's right. basically 5% of the, or 10% of right. what they were making.
Right. Well, and right. But it's also true. I think it's important to say this, though. It's also true that over that period, the top marginal tax rate was never less than 70%, and at some points it was as high as 94%. While I agree with everything that you said, I would also say that there was also at the time a lot of pressure on the system to provide some social goods, and a lot of them were social goods that were a lot better for the wealthy. For example, the interstate highway system produced an awful lot of wealth because it allowed freer transport of goods and services, which created a lot of wealth for the wealthy and made it easier to exploit more people over a broader area and collect more of their more of the value that they created. But there was also this period where, at least for some people, we were doing a bit of taking some of the wealth and putting it into some social services. But again, we had redlining so that some of that money that was supposed to be going
social
to help people
or specific communities.
Yeah, it was actually being funneled to very specific communities, which were primarily white
middle
sure.
class.
So we took
yes,
money
yes.
from brown people.
Yeah.
Right, gave it to wealthy white people,
right,
and then took from them
took
by force,
it, yeah.
right, as a forced tip, like when you go to the restaurant and
yeah.
they force the tip on you,
mm-hmm.
right? So they took a forced tip
yeah.
from them, give it to white people, and yeah. then gave any of it
right.
to the
exactly.
black people.
Exactly.
Right? So that's basically
right.
what it is.
Mm-hmm.
So if anyone is trying to much as let's go back to FDR.
Right.
Right. And Bernie Sanders does a lot of that.
Right.
I mean, I understand that he was trying to make it clearer to people,
mm-hmm.
Like the idea that he's talking about.
Right.
But
works,
I think that
programs, jobs, programs.
Right.
Yes. But that
yeah.
violates the concept of solidarity, because every time he says that, right, he is leaving behind the Japanese Americans. He is leaving mm-hmm. behind everybody around the world. He is leaving behind the fact that I am here because of immigration laws that has changed. because of the influx of people from my part of the world coming here because they were exploited in the first place. Mm-hmm. So the more educated, the more well off, mm-hmm. right, try to escape there and come over here, right? So when you say right. that, you are leaving a lot of people yes. behind. You are leaving black people behind
yep.
completely when you say that.
Right. Well, we are out of time.
Okay.
So I'm gonna end it right there. But I would really appreciate you being here.
Oh, thank you.
It's always great talking to you.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you for listening to this episode of State of the Revolution. You can find us on Facebook at Michigan Progressive. And if you'd like to support what we do, please subscribe at patreon.com/Michigan Progressive. Thank you to my co-hosts, Mara and Liana.
Thanks for having me.
I'm Benjamin Kwan, and we'll be back with another episode very soon. Bye.
Bye.
Thanks, guys.